This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, recently we had Jason LaDany, who had been coming through the U.S. on a lecture tour that I had arranged, and he was coming from Albany, New York, actually his home, and driving down to the southeast and then across the country all the way to the west coast. And so while he was in Houston, had an opportunity to sit down and chat with him. He is one of today's foremost card magicians, no questions. If you see him anywhere and he is sessioning with some people, kind of stand on the periphery a little bit. I think you'll learn a lot and you'll certainly enjoy watching him. And the more people who have seen him, who are organizers of conventions, have said, we want you to move from the front room over here or the back room and wherever you're sessioning in the bars or wherever, and come over here and teach the rest of the people who are the registrants, because this is fantastic. Anybody who's seen him has to agree that he is one of the best card guys around. And when he was giving his lecture here, it was some pretty hardcore stuff. There were a couple of things that were more simple, certainly that were within the reach of anyone, but it's just a beautiful thing to behold, you know, to watch his lecture. I don't do a memorized deck, but he has got some a lot of good touches on the mem deck, as well as other kinds of things that he teaches, that have to do with some card slights and things. It certainly is a lot of knuckle-busting things. It is pure card. So I think that's why perhaps there were just so, well, I'll say few, there weren't as many people who had booked his lecture across the U.S. as I had thought would be interested. And I think that's because, again, that it is very card heavy. So if you happen to enjoy cards, I would recommend this. In fact, he's got a new book out that's going to be released at Magic Live. It's called Game Changer. And it is not necessarily a follow-up. He's got another book out, a couple of books. So he's been writing for a while and teaching magic. But Game Changer is a good way of looking at it, because his philosophy is a little bit different, in which that he actually has a different way of looking at magic, such that it is not necessarily from the theoretical side so much it is from a philosophical side, and what it is that makes the audience really react in a visceral way, and to make it so it's something important to them, if you will. Anyhow, my point is, I guess, that it's something that is going to be, I think, a very good book, and it's not available yet, but again, will be introduced here coming up in August at the Magic Live, and it's called Game Changer. So if you want to learn some other great material for your card act, then it's a book that would be recommended from what little I've seen of it so far, and also from what I have seen and what I know of Jason LaDany. And this week you're going to get an opportunity to learn a lot more from him then as well, in this kind of a little bit of a mini lecture, because you hear a lot about his background. I didn't realize that he had such a background in music. Well, I'm not going to spoil so much of this, but you're going to enjoy listening to my guest this week. So please welcome Jason LaDany here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have someone special with me here this week, and he has been traveling across the U.S. Actually, he's all the way from New York and has driven down from Albany, is that right? All the way from
Albany, New York?
Yeah, Albany, New York, and has been going across the country on this lecture tour, and he's here in Houston then right now, and he's one of the top card guys. If you haven't had an opportunity to see him on this lecture tour, you are just out of luck for this time, but you'll get a chance to see him somewhere else, or perhaps you might be able to catch him whenever that, if you want to go and see his At the Table lecture that's available over on Murphy's Magic. Nevertheless, he is just one skilled magician. He's a great mechanic, but besides that, just a really nice, likable, charismatic, handsome man. Please welcome my friend, Jason LaDany. Hey there, Jason.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I appreciate it very much. And I got to say, you know, you're right. So I thank you for noticing that.
Certainly, yes. It's that jawline and everything.
And the high cheekbones.
And high cheekbones. That's what it is.
You know, all that patter that I use, those ad-libs and everything, comes directly from my mom. If anyone's wondering, that's where that stuff comes from, hearing that for 20 years.
Yeah, she was the one who said, oh, you're a handsome man. Yeah. You know? So she was life-affirming. She was giving you a lot of good...
Everything. If I put a Band-Aid on, my mom would tell me that I could be a doctor someday. So if I, you know, made toast, she would say I could be a 5-star, you know, culinary master someday.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's great to have someone who's going to be able to affirm... you know, the positivity of you as you're growing up, you know.
That really was her. And think about this, for having a mom, I would say, Mom, I want to be a piano player and a guitar player and a professional card cheat, you know. And she'd go, that's great, sweetie, you know. And she'd be like, I don't really know about the card cheating thing. But I, you know, because you don't want to I was a single mom, obviously, that brought me up. We were talking earlier about that. So. Uh-huh. But you don't want that mom that says, you know, no, you're going to give this stupid stuff up and, you know, get a real job and those kind of things. So fortunately, I never had that issue. It seemed like when I was younger, anything I did, I had that support. And you know, here we are.
Yeah, well, that's great.
I'm glad that happened. Yeah. So and she pushed me in arts and music and things along that nature. And even very early, I knew that I didn't like that idea of having some sort of desk job, you know, mm-hmm. pushing papers.
It was always artist of
some
sort.
Just knew that I was either going to be an actor or an artist or something of that nature, a movie star, you know, mm-hmm. some stunt guy or things like that. And I knew that that whole thing of going somewhere in some box and having some guy tell you what to do all day or...
Right.
Filing papers. Just wasn't,
it just wasn't for you.
I knew it. Even at like 8 years old, I just knew that that wasn't the thing. So that's why. I always excelled in things in art and music in school and things like that. And chemistry, I would be like, you know, what is the point of this? You know, this is so stupid.
Because you weren't going to be going into science. You were going to be a doctor.
Yeah,
you
and going social to be studies. And I remember thinking, like, all I'm doing is memorizing dates. I'm not learning. I didn't know it at the time, but I was kind of seeing through the system a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sense, through having piano lessons at an early age, I could sense what real lessons were like. And having a real teacher who had information and had to break it down in a way to make you understand it and cared that he could share with you what he learned in his life, break mm-hmm. it down so you could learn it. And also a piano teacher, his job is to inspire you.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that, and the creativity, and everything is coming in the right way because there's a real goal. And I would compare that to when I went to school and I had some guy reading through some curriculum, like, you got to do this today. Like, he didn't care. That person didn't care. And if you didn't learn, the class moved on anyway. And so
could be left behind.
Yeah, I could sense these teachers in school don't care. And it's all just canned stuff and memorizing dates, and none of this means anything. And I'd like, and you know what? I'm right. I still haven't flipped a triangle maintaining the three angles in my life. I've never done that ever. Kids, if you're listening, I've never needed to know how many neutrons and protons are in a particular element. You know, so anyway.
But there are schools for performing artists.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And I knew from when I went to my piano lessons, I felt knowledge and I felt care and I felt mm-hmm. That I was inspired and I wanted to learn that stuff. And of course, I learned the piano stuff very well. I learned everything very well. Mm-hmm. And in school, by the end, I was really struggling just to get through it. You know, I graduated and everything, but I remember thinking, like, I don't want to have anything to do with this all.
But you didn't take drama or anything then? Or
no, our school, the school that I went to really didn't offer, our school wasn't that, it was a little bit poor. So they were one of the schools that cut a lot of
the arts.
Things mm-hmm. like that. So there was a music theory program and a music history program that I was part of. And you were getting like college credits and things like that. But it was funny because I had learned, so I had taken piano lessons from when I was 7. So when I was in my music history and theory classes, I was the kid like sitting in the back of the class with my feet up, you know, mm-hmm. answering the questions before the teacher could finish.
Yeah.
You know, and I would also give the teacher harder questions to answer his questions. Okay. So that he would ask the class like, what is a sharp 5 in F? And I would say, well, it's a sharp 15 in C. You know what I mean? And like give him a more complicated answer to solve. And so I was that kid. But I just remember that the academic thing I didn't like.
But you decided to stay in New York rather than moving like to LA or something.
And... that's not true. When I finished, I was still in high school and I was playing with a bunch of local bands. And so I was 15 years old, sitting in like, you know, economics class or whatever. And I remember thinking like, who else in this classroom is driving to Chicago tomorrow to perform at Buddy Guy's Legends, you know, with Buddy Guy on stage?
Wow.
And so I was playing with this band called Ernie Williams at the time, and I was only 15, and he was an old black blues guy from Virginia, and he mm-hmm. was 70-something years old. So we had this weird gaffe of, in one band, we have a 15-year-old, a couple of 40-year-old guys, and a 71-year-old blues guy, you know?
Wow.
And so I was playing with those guys at the time. And remember, I started playing piano when I was 7, so I learned a lot.
Sure.
Kind of broke onto the scene with 8 years of experience. So mm-hmm. I, you know, mm-hmm. they liked the style that I played, and I was really into authentic blues, you know. And so I was playing with that band, and then over the next couple of years, we played around the country a bit, Boston and Chicago and things like that. And I started seeing a few more of the national bands we would run into, opening up for them or meeting or networking mm-hmm. and things.
Sure.
So when I was 18, I got picked up by an artist right here in Texas, actually. So, Sunset Heights, does that ring a bell? It's a little city. Yeah. It's just a little suburb somewhere around here. But his name was Vince Converse, and he was a guitar slinger, kind of like Steve Ray Vaughan. Who's the other kid? The young guitar slingers, Johnny Lang and Kenny Wayne Shepherd, those kind of younger guitar slingers from Texas who were copying Steve Ray Vaughan.
Uh-huh.
Vince was one of those, but he wasn't as popular yet. So I had joined his band, and they bought a home in New Orleans as a kind of a central hub for where the band would live. And when I graduated high school, I got the phone call like, hey, you're hired. We just signed you, and we're moving. You know, the band's based out of New Orleans, so pack your stuff because that's where the band lives. So I had to tell my mom, like, hey, you know, what's for dinner tonight? And by the way, I'm moving to New Orleans tomorrow. And of course, my mom said, oh, that's great. You know what I mean? And I'm like, all right. You know, of course, she, you know, was worried sick, but she also knew that, you know, I had a great opportunity. And I, like, you know, something out of a cartoon. I'm 18 years old. So, I mean, you live out of your bedroom, you know, it's all the stuff you have. So I took my comforter and I put all my belongings in it and rolled it up like a burrito. And I put it into my car and I drove 27 hours to New Orleans to my new home. You know, that's how that worked.
And how long did you live in New Orleans?
I lived there for about a year. And it's funny, too, because about this drive that we're talking about, and we got to drive home tomorrow, which is almost the same amount of distance. But I got
from Houston to Albany.
I got hired in that band on a Tuesday. And they said the first gig was in New Orleans. We were playing with Tab Benoit, who's a great guitar player. And the gig was on like Thursday at 9 or something. So I'm like, I got to go buy luggage and everything. So I just like, I couldn't believe it. I had to leave the house, drive all day, all night. And of course, I drove all the way there and I got there like 30 minutes before the gig, you know. And, you know, those are the kind of things that I did in my life. And at the time, when you're younger like that, you just do it. You just,
right.
I mean, what else am I going to do? I just got hired in a band. What am I going to say? No.
And you're excited.
Yeah, exactly. So here I am touring around the country. And, I joined that band. I was with those guys for about a year and a half or something. And then of course, like with any other business, you just move up the food chain, you know? So when mm-hmm. we were playing with Vince, we were exposed to even bigger bands.
Sure.
We opened up for the Doobie Brothers in Chicago and big artists like that. And
did you travel with those bands then, or you just happened to be in the same city as they were passing through?
Yeah, not with Vince. With Vince, it was just hit or miss. Sometimes we'd be in little blues clubs, and other times we'd be at
major... Did you have an agent that booked you?
Thunderbird Management was the name of that company. And they had a lot of different artists, but Vince was younger, so he didn't have the same pull. You know, he didn't... So he was getting... things that other bands maybe didn't want. He was a little lower on the food chain. So we took what we could get. And we were driving in a van, and sometimes we wouldn't get rooms. And, you know, it was a little rough in the beginning.
Sometimes sleeping in the van,
guess. Because we didn't have the tour management. We didn't have any... we had a booking agent that would book the dates, but we didn't have, like, a road manager.
You know,
we were just... The drummer's driving. And then, you know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So, but when you... when you work like that, you're meeting and networking and playing with other bands and doing gigs with other bands a lot, and you meet a lot of people. So I had left Vince's band And I had a straight gig for like 2 weeks. I worked at a bank, if you can believe it. I was a bank teller. You know, Mr. Con artist here, counting people's money. You know, Elmsley
Trust
counts,
me.
You know. Yeah, yeah. That's weird. I just counted it and you had 100 a minute ago. So anyway.
I'll be horse-woggled.
And, you know, and it's funny too, because like the corporate world and I just do not gel. Because I would wake up and I had like crazy bedhead and I just put on a shirt and go to work. And the manager mm-hmm. would be like, you know, like, we appreciate you wearing a shirt and tie, but could you like, you know, maybe clean something with
bit.
Your hair? You know, and I'm like, I'm counting people's money. What more do you want, man? You know? So, and at that age too, you like, you basically just, when the alarm goes off, you hit the snooze, get in the car and drive to work and put your tie on as you're driving to work.
Yeah.
But anyway, when I had left that Vince's gig and I was had this little stupid job at a bank and next thing you know, I'm at the bank and the phone rings and it's Shamika Copeland's manager and she's a much bigger artist. She was signed with a real label and everything. And the guy on the phone was her manager and he said, hey, listen, you know, we saw you in New York one time playing with Vince, mm-hmm. you know, and he said, we're looking to sign you and go out on the road with the band. And they were all fly dates and
wow.
Europe and
wow.
and we had a road manager. We had a real booking agent. We, you know, everything.
You can hardly believe the phone call that you were getting.
Oh, and I was at that job too.
Yeah.
So I remember it's like something from a movie. I hung the phone up and I went over to my manager and I said, I'm going to have to quit because
yeah.
I've to have a gig in
yeah.
Washington, D.C., like in a couple of days. I got to go get a passport. And I just joined like a real national touring band, like an international touring band, actually. And he was like, well, that's great, but you can't do that. You have to give us 2 weeks. And I said, like, it's just from a movie. I was like, but my gig's this Thursday. And he goes, you can't just leave. You can't do that. You have to give, in this world, you have to give 2 weeks notice. And after your 2 weeks are done, then you can leave or reflect badly on your next job or whatever. And I just like slowly was backing away. And the other manager behind him, she was a woman and she was a great friend of mine. And she was just giggling and she just whispered, like, she just gave me that little nudge, like, just ignore him and just go.
Yeah.
And he had that stern face and like, you can't do
you
this.
Can't leave.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You cannot leave. You need to stay the rest of the day. And that was his bargaining chip. Like, you at least need to stay the rest of the day. And I just backed out and said, you know, like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I just left and I drove straight to Macy's, I think. And I bought luggage. Same thing as the Vince thing. I just I just bought the stuff and bought new clothes and went to the post office and did my expedited passport thing and left. And I played with Shamika for about 5.5 years.
Wow.
All over the world. We did Australia, Europe, just nonstop touring. And we played in front of major acts.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Beck, Buddy Guy, BB King. We toured with BB for 6 months at a time. And that's what you were talking about. The touring agent just gets you in front of the right artist and you're just kind of piggybacking along with them. But you get 10,000 people to come to a giant blues fest to see BB King and you're getting
and
exposed.
You're there too,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's a very, very smart business thing. And that's how those guys are able to grow bands.
Because those bands also will see certain people and say, well, I want to take this guy or that lady or whatever.
Exactly.
And so you
get
a tour
and
with
that's
the
how they make
groups.
Those blues fests. And then you get to one and then they hear about it. And then that's how you get the phone calls and all this. And those festivals pay major money. Those are, they probably have those things here right
sure.
in town. It's any time that they take like a major street right in town, like a real busy intersection, they shut it down and they build all those stages and it's a 3-day event. It's
of course, the big one is over in New Orleans that they have.
Yeah. They had Dave Matthews there when I was doing it. And that's the big, the huge one. And we did, I forget what it's called.
It's right after Mardi Gras. Around
yeah. Yeah. I forget the name of it, but we did that one. There's the Montreal Blues Fest. There's, but basically anytime there's something like the Verizon something Blues Fest and it's a 3-day event and all the vendors come in and those things, they pay like 20, 30 grand, you know? So and we would get that money. And so that was a great career to have. And of course, bringing this back to magic, while I was on the road, what do you do on an 8-hour flight?
Right.
Or what do you do on a 16-hour drive across the country? We drove across from California to New York in that band 10 times at least. All the, driving through the Rockies, through the, Iowa?
Like in a touring, a tour bus, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what are the worst states? Nebraska, Iowa, and Ohio. So it's just like cornfields, you know, those types of states.
Mm-hmm.
And on those trips, I'd be reading Strong Magic and doing second deals. And that's how I got my chops because I had
nothing else to do. What was the first book that inspired you?
Well, I had all sorts of...
I mean, Strong Magic's not one you just jump into. I mean, it's more theory and as opposed to a lot of...
But it's fascinating.
Well, it is.
It is
Darwin
fascinating.
Darwin Ortiz has a great book.
Because I found that there, I was getting much more reward out of that book because I was learning the whys of how things worked. And when I read a card book, I was just getting the one-time thing. So a great mm-hmm. analogy for me is like a cookbook. You can buy a cookbook and there's a 7-step recipe. You know, buy these 6 ingredients and put them in the pot in this order. But do you know how to cook after that? No, you have no idea. You only know how to make that one recipe because you followed it in that particular order.
Right.
So I could sense that when I was reading card magic books, I would read the effect and I'm just kind of like, okay, that's interesting, you know. And the trick did the one thing. But when I read Strong Magic, I was really getting the behind the scenes. In other words, learning how to cook, you know. So once you understand more how to cook and you're a chef, when you read that recipe, you can look at it as a guideline. Oh, I see. So maybe I'll do it this way instead. But since you understand, you'll know it'll still work. So cooking is a funny analogy too, because once you do understand how to cook, like when my mom would cook, she would just throw things in. You ever notice that?
Not necessarily measuring. You're just kind of pinch of this and dash of that.
Because she knows how it works. And then she understands that when she opens up the fridge and there's no chicken or something, she'd go, oh, well, I'll just use this instead. And if you're a beginner cook, you would never do that. You'd go, oh, well, I don't have chicken. I can't make it. Yeah, I can't make this dish because I don't have a half tablespoon of that spice or whatever. So reading Strong Magic really started to unlock a lot of mysteries that I had about the whys and about the character and about dramatic structure and tension and how to get your audience engaged, all the things that we talked about in the lecture today, right. Really. And then when I would read card magic books that just had tricks and such, I was able to analyze them either in a good way or bad way. I'd say, well, oh, I see what he's doing here, but he never really gave the
why.
Didn't
explain the justification
as
to why they did
this
that.
Is a weird moment here, or... like, what is the effect here? Why? So a lot of interesting things are happening, but it doesn't really make any sense. There's like 3 effects all kind of jumbled into one. But I would rather have that thought process than, oh, let me try this and see if it works. So once you understand mm-hmm. your theory, you can read it and really start to see the potential before you even go out and do it, because you really got the ins and outs and understanding it. But that was only the very beginning. I mean, you have to read that book 10 times before it really starts to mm-hmm. Click. And I did. I read that book until the binding broke. Well, that's a true story. Mm-hmm. I have it at home. You open the book and all the pages fall out.
Falling apart.
Yeah, I tried gluing it back together and everything. And one time I showed Darwin that book. I brought it down to a session with him and I said, I want to show you something. And I pulled out this 2 black pieces of cardboard with like 360 loose pages. And he's like, I'll just give you another one.
I've got another copy.
He did give me a fresh copy, but that's... just to prove how many times I went through that book to make sense of it.
Well, that is important that you learn how to cook, not just what the ingredients are. That is a big difference.
It's the whole teach a man to fish thing. It really is that. So, and then of course, even reading it isn't good enough. You have to read it, get a basic comprehension of it. Like you think you know it. You know, you read it and you go, oh, I get this now. But then you got to go out in the real world and mm-hmm. perform for real people in a real environment and put those things to the test and see, do they work? And then you can reflect on it after the fact and say, oh, I tried it and I saw that that made a big difference, you know. But you don't just do one performance. You have to do multiple performances and start really weighing the stuff, because, you know, in a live performance, it's very hard to get it to go exactly the way you want.
That's a lot to do, I think, with rhythm also. Then from the standpoint, Jason, you have to speed up, you slow down, and you were doing that a lot in the lecture today, for an example, as you were starting to count the cards, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you start, you know, you build some impact and things like that. And there are different important parts of your show in order to get the maximum impact by having those kinds of moments where you're going to have a pause for a great effect. And then another time you speed it up.
And how long do you pause? And how much do you speed up? So when you read the book and then you go out and try it, one chance and one try isn't going to prove anything. Mm-hmm. You need to then try it a second night and compare it to the last time you did it. And then a third time. And like any scientific test, you start over time starting to see, oh, I get it. I'm just finding the right amount to do this. And multiple performances of thinking about one concept from that book start to teach you, like, oh, I'm starting to get this now. Mm-hmm. He's right. I read this and it makes perfect sense. And I know it's right because I've tried it both ways multiple times. Now, that's only one little thing. Then you go through the book and try the next thing, like the act or the character or any of the topics in that book. And again, bring it back out into the real field and try it multiple times, weigh it, think about it, you know. And
well, it has to fit your character.
Yeah,
also,
yeah, exactly.
Because you could read the book and apply one thing to a trick you're doing. I could read it and apply it, and it just doesn't work for my character.
And that's why it's so important to know who you are before you can even apply any of this stuff, you know? So
how do you find yourself?
It is that's a great question. And it is very difficult, but what I've noticed is I've heard magicians say this before, be yourself, you know, and you never really know what that
means.
Who
are you? Yeah.
And, but now that I've really started to kind of refine this character, like I found it, you know, over the last 5-6 years, even from the first DVD set, I've noticed a change from when I watched those videos. I'm not that person anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's even more developed. But what I've realized when they say be yourself is, It is myself, but it's this extremely exaggerated version, because being yourself can be rather boring. So you find what your character traits are and then exaggerate them like a lot. So the ego thing,
yes,
the things that I said tonight on stage, you know, that's...
You wouldn't say in normal conversation, of course.
I would never ever say that in real life. Like look to a girl and say, oh, you've got such beautiful eyes, you know, and if I look at them just right, I can catch a reflection of myself. I mean, you know, they're, you know what I mean? So,
right.
So you would never, ever say that in a million years. Or you would never say, you know, sorry, I was late to work. I was just looking at myself in the mirror again, and I'm sorry.
Kind of distracted.
Yeah, I just, you know, those high cheekbones and the perfectly textured hair and the piercing green eyes is a reason to be late, if you ask me. Now, the audience loves that stuff, you know, because who's that full of themselves, you know?
Right.
So those little things kind of creep into your character, and then you just roll with it, you know? And so what else?
The just like Jeff Hobson did, I guess, whenever he found his character as a gay magician, I mean, so just kind of clicked.
And then go with it all the way. It's all or nothing.
All in.
Mm-hmm. So an audience loves... You know, theater is that exaggeration thing. So mm-hmm. we want to blow things way out of proportion so they're exciting to watch. No one would... To be your real self, I mean, what is that?
It's boring.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very difficult when a magician says that, oh, yeah, just be yourself. It's really hollow advice there. So, but at the same time, it's like find yourself and then get in there and blow things out of proportion so you're exciting to watch. So it's complicated. It's got the con man thing. I mean, when I was 6-7 years old, we were dirt poor, and my dad would give me food to shoplift. I didn't know it. He would say, here, hold this stuff. You know, put this in your pants and do this and that thing. And I thought, oh, cool. Dad's making me. I'm doing stuff with dad, you know?
Yeah, right.
And his thing was, oh, if he gets caught, he can blame it on his kid that didn't know any better, you know?
Yeah.
So, but there's the beginning of the con man thing. And so... There's something, I mean, when I was younger, I used to sneak into the movies all the time because we would just recycle the same old movie stub. So you'd pay for the movie once mm-hmm. and then you'd come back the next day with the old stub from yesterday, you know, and you'd walk through. But as long as you look like you were having an important conversation with your friend,
right,
they wouldn't want to stop you. The little 16-year-old kid there felt like he's interrupting your conversation. So it looked like he owned the place,
that's right.
You know? So it was funny because we'd always have to come up with an important conversation as we were walking in. So we couldn't be interrupted. So I'd mm-hmm. be like, and then, you know, the car rolled over like 3 times. So I like reached over and just before the car flipped, I jammed the seatbelt. Oh yeah, here's our stub, you know? And we'd walk past the guy, you know, and then continue the conversation. And my friend Jay'd be like, so did you guys, were you okay? You know? And I'd be like, well, yeah, I got this little scar here, but and then like 2 nights later, you know, he'd be walking in and he'd be like, so I told the guy, either I'm going to fire you or you start doing your work. And then I'd be like, so what happened? Did you fire him? Oh, yeah. Here's our stuff. So what happened? Well, he straightened his act up and now he's vice president.
So you learned to be a con man early.
Yeah, so we would keep trying coming up with new stories every time we came in.
Yeah.
And we did everything from trying to find, when once we were in the movie theater, we found the room, like the stock room, or not the stock, but the employee's lounge, where there was vests that said like Hoyts. So we took the Hoyts vests so that we would just wear the vest, you know, that one never panned out because it's like, well, do we work here or not, you know? But we were constantly thinking like, how do we get into these movie theaters? We went so far as to, we found like emergency exits that we could go, like in the mall, like you'd mm-hmm. go through a fire exit and you'd be like behind the mall.
Yeah.
And if you walked far enough, you'd end up coming out some fire exit in the back of the movie theater. So we found like back ways in and all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the con man thing is there, you know what? So it's
it's like method acting. If you've had some of that experience, you know, when you're on stage creating these cons with cards, you know, you've got some real life experience
that
to
you can call on.
Yeah. So that's why actors do it. You know, an actor will put himself in a solitary confinement for 3 weeks because the part he's going to play needs to know how it's not just like, oh, let me pretend I've been locked in a room for a while. They need to start to experience that real emotion.
Right.
So the con man thing's there. The ego thing is there. Obviously the card shark, the criminal side of it, you know? So your character needs to have some sort of backstory, you know, and my character, obviously I've been in jail, in and out of jail all the time. And somebody got me bad once. And that's the thing that drives me, you know, that I've got that chip on my shoulder that that I need to prove that I'm the best because of that one time that somebody got something. Like, that's always kind of an underlining thing there. So all this stuff just boils down to you need to sit down and think about what you are. And the more time you spend thinking and analyzing and creating what you are, the clearer that picture of who you are really is.
And maybe an amalgamation of other people. And that's something a lot of times people tend to clone just with that one person. But I think that there's nothing wrong with cloning somebody if it's just a portion of their personality. But if you clone this guy and that guy and this lady and somebody else, that you are then an amalgamation of somebody, that you're not just copying somebody else's act. You are original then.
Now, here's what happens. So I've got a few things to say about this. First of all, when I was learning through Darwin, I copied Darwin perfectly. Mm-hmm. Like, that was my thing.
Yeah.
Because he was my mentor. Mm-hmm. But my brain works that way. That's how I learn. Because when I had a piano teacher, I emulated him. I had to copy him perfectly. But I needed to learn. So I would learn through copying. And then over time, that part goes away. That was the stepping stone to help you understand something, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's why when we teach kids how to play piano, we teach them Beethoven, we teach them all this other thing.
Same with painters. You know, some painters will follow their teacher because that's what they teach them before they finally find their own style.
Exactly. Now, I did the same exact thing with guitar. When I learned how to play guitar, I played B.B. King note for note. I have a 335 at home. That's B.B. King's guitar. Played through a solid state amp. That's B.B. King's amp. Mm-hmm. And I had his vibrato down. I listened to Live at the Regal, which is one of his big staple albums. I listened to that thing on a cassette tape on A, B, A, B, A, B in my car because it would just, you know, remember your cars would just, for all of high school. That's 4 years, same cassette tape, which means that I could play Live at the Regal on the guitar perfectly from, I knew every lick. I could emulate it perfectly. So when I would go on stage and play guitar, it was note for note. Mm-hmm. And of course, it didn't matter what song it was because we weren't playing B.B. King all the time. We were playing anything, but still B.B. King would come every single time until the guitar player came to me and said, like, dude, like, yes, you sound more like B.B. King than B.B. does, but you got to find who you are. Now, what you said is true because I went through the next phase of copying Albert King. Then I went through copying Stevie Ray Vaughan, copy everybody, you know? And what happens is you become this big mold of all these people, and you're playing little bits of this person sewn into this, and here's how it becomes original. It's how do you choose to pull all of your different influences in at one time? What order do you pick them off the shelf in? And that's what makes the creative, the true original part. It's not that you just did one lick of this guy and one lick of that guy. So you can't be creative by doing one Darwin Ortiz trick and then one Michael Amar trick. And, you know, it's pulling from all different people at multiple times creates this unique thing. So I use Darwin as a stepping stone to understand scripting. But I knew that it was well-constructed material, so I knew that I was in the right place. So once I got his understanding of how he scripts and how he constructs effects and his technique and stuff, I grew out of that and started creating my own material. But it's still heavily influenced by him.
Yeah.
And the characters are similar. I think I'm a little more edgy than Darwin. I think I have a little bit, like the ego.
I can see that, certainly. I've seen Darwin perform, and he's completely different from
I'm a little bit more ballsy, a little bit more harsh on some of the lines. We were talking about this in the lecture. I get people to like me, but I can deliver a little bit more pointed lines, and I know that the audience likes this stuff because they laugh, and it never digs in the way like a real arrogant line or a real condescending line, but I can say very condescending things in the audience.
Well, what about other books after that, as far as Strong Magic? Are there other books that were more about theory, let's say?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head that comes anything
Juan
close
Tamara's? I mean,
to
you know,
Strong Magic. Yes, Juan has obviously written a lot of very strong things, but what I notice when I read that, I say, oh, this is the thing that was in Strong Magic. It's just said in a different way. He has a different language and a different way of saying it, but the mm-hmm. concept is the same. So I've noticed there's a lot of repeat information right. there. But honestly, acting books and...
Pete McCabe's got one on scripting.
But it's not even... I don't stay away from the magic stuff a lot. I will look mm-hmm. right on the behind the scenes... on DVD, when you buy a DVD and you go out the commentary, mm-hmm. I'm missing the word right now, the director's whatever.
Cut.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you hear the actors talking about, well, in this scene, I did this to prepare for the act, and I understand my character is, you know, this is what the character's saying. I understand my character was very depraved in this scene, and I spent 3 weeks in an insane asylum to watch and learn and see. And I came this way and I learned this technique, and that's why, what movie was that? 15 minutes or something that the actor actually, under the table, held a lit match on his palm.
Wow.
So that he could have a particular look of fear and anxiety and really intense struggle in his face mm-hmm. because his skin was burning, you know?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I think the movie, De Niro flick, I think it was called 15 Minutes and about this crazy actor that, or this crazy guy that wanted to kill the police officer or something. I don't quote me on this, but I think that was the name of the movie. But the actor, I remember the commentary because holding a lit match under the table off camera, and the camera was tight in on his face, so you'd see all the wincing and the
yeah, because it was real.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
and they kept that.
That's the one uh-huh. they kept because there was something different in his face. The fear was the.
So what you're saying is there are things that are outside magic. Obviously, oh
my
study,
god, yes.
Of course.
Why stay within? Yeah,
I say that to people all the time. Yeah, expand your world.
Oh,
there is a lot
God,
more than just magic.
I can watch guys. Anybody, I've written this in a blog before. Anybody that's at the top of their game has something to offer you.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if it's golf, acting, art, whatever. It's all related.
Yeah,
I think Da Vinci says that. It's like it's all related. You just have to learn how to see it. You know,
mm-hmm.
and it's very similar to that. So I can look at someone and say, you know, how did Jordan get so tech or Tiger Woods when he was in I hate using him as an analogy anymore because back in when his thing was going back in 2007 and 8 and everything, he was like the perfect guy to study and mm-hmm. you know, how does he spend all day out there? What drives him and all that? So he was a great person to pull from and read about and listen to. And
well, your magic is a little bit different also as far as your lecture goes too, because there are some lecturers who come through and talk about here is the method of how you do this and this, you know, show a trick and then they'll explain a short trick and then they explain. But then others will talk also about the theory behind why they're doing that. But you talk about something deeper, I think, even yet than theory, and that is the philosophy of why that you're doing it, which goes again, beyond theory.
Oh, my God, yeah. I like to let the audience... I don't want them to think too much and have to figure this stuff out on their own. But I have to do it in a subtle way that I'm making little suggestions to help them kind of carry along.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to make sure that when I perform something, I'm always letting them know why this is a useful skill to have. Because magic can be weird. Magic can just be like, look, it's a golf ball, now it's a fish. And the audience goes, wow, that's amazing. And of course, the magician goes, well, that got a great reaction. That's awesome because it's a golf ball and now it's a fish.
Yeah.
But why do you have a golf ball?
To begin with.
To begin with. And why is it a fish? And why, you know, what is this? So this comes.
What is the motivation?
Yeah, this turns into the shock value thing. Yes, that's amazing. But let's put some context around mm-hmm. that. So the bubble gum trick that people, you know, the gum changes color. Again, it's a visual moment, but why are you changing gum?
Well, you had a good point. Like the clouds parted. And
oh
God
yeah,
says,
yeah. I say this a lot in my lecture. I say, you know, some magician says, look, I linked two lifesavers together, and I say, well, that's first of all, yes, that's amazing. It's impossible, but you know, when have you ever been somewhere when somebody says, oh my God, that woman just fell over and I don't think she's going to be okay. Does anyone here have two lifesavers that they can link together? I think this poor woman's dying, you know, it's like, that's not what we need right now.
Yeah.
So I like to make sure, I have to make myself clear. I'm not saying that linking two lifesavers together is a bad effect. It's a great effect. But my approach to magic is, let's find a reason to make that a thing.
Right.
I want the audience, just before I do it, to say, well, that's impossible. But the only way that he could win that bet, or the only way he could be the hero, is if he could link those rings. But that would be impossible. You know, I want them to to have it all make sense and realize that that's impossible to do, but that's what he needs to do right now.
Right, right.
So there's a trick I do where I have a card that's put back together, a torn and restored card, which never makes any sense. Why are you putting the card back together? But in the routine that I do, it's someone else that rips the card up. So I didn't rip the card up. It's a villain. You know, it's a somebody that is giving me trouble.
Antagonist.
And of course, the card has the girlfriend's phone number on it. So now the card is valuable. Mm-hmm. So the boyfriend, the ex-boyfriend, or the boyfriend of this woman took the card away and had her number on it, and it tore it up. And then it's my job to put that card back together, because I want her phone number and I want him to look, you know, I want to be the hero again, you know?
Right.
So I'm always trying. And Ortiz has a great handling of it too. It's a marker. It's an IOU. It's a $5,000 IOU that the guy tears up, and now he's lost $5,000. Mm-hmm. So the only reason to put that card back together is, you know, I'm going to use my magical powers to put that back together because I want my $5,000.
Right.
So, you know, make that make sense. So the back to the lifesavers thing, you just have to, or for me anyway, I'm not saying that this is like, if you're doing the trick, you have to come up with a new way. But my approach is to say, you know, here's the problem and the solution is to do this, but that's impossible. But if you could do it, it would look like this. And now, you know, you've made it make sense. You've shown them that they're linked, and you've given them some sort of reason why you're going to do it and why it's useful. So I try to take those elements and apply them to every single thing I did. If you look at every trick I did,
yeah,
it had a reason for why I'm doing it. I was the hero in all of them.
Well, that was my point. I think, yeah, you know, it seemed more like a little play, you know, within play.
You nailed it. It's a movie. I look at them like each one's a little movie. It's a little short 3-minute movie or something. There's going to be suspense and tension, and there's going to be reasoning. And and here's another guideline that you can use, and writers use this too. It's the either you're doing and then style of writing, or you're doing the because style of writing. Mm-hmm. And if you do the and then style of writing, that just means it's a random thing. And then this happened, and then this happened, and then this building blew up, and then this car chase happened, and then this thing, you know, this fell out of the sky. Well, none of those are
they're not related.
Because you're saying and then. And if you say because, well, now it's a whole different thing. The building blew up because because this happened, now you need a reason for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, because this fell out of the sky, because this guy did this.
And that's
then
more holistic.
And now, if you look at all those tricks, when we apply that because thinking, you'll see that let's look at that first trick. I find the aces and the cards in less than 60 seconds.
Yeah.
It's my ego. It's because of my ego that I'm willing to bet that money that I want to find those cards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each one gets a little bit more exciting. And when I get to the end, I have to change the cards because I don't want to lose the $100.
Correct.
You can take that.
And there's some drama because you have, you're on the clock.
Yeah, racing against the clock. And that's, again, my ego. Why am I pitting myself against the clock? It's because my ego. See what I mean? So everything, that's the motivation is constantly like, look how good I am.
Well, you were also saying something about how that you don't want your act to seem as if it's one pick a card after another. I mean, you do very few
never,
pick a card.
I never, ever, ever think I've ever had anybody pick a card and then I find it. I just don't do that material. Now, inside of each trick, there may be that sequence of someone selecting a card, but there's always some much, much, much grander
scheme. There's a lot more going on rather than just lose it and find it.
So let's say, let me write you a James Bond movie right now.
Okay.
Movie starts.
My favorite.
James Bond comes out. And he pulls out a gun and he walks up to the villain and he shoots him. The end. I mean, how stupid of a movie. That's it, right? But that's essentially what happens in the mall anyway.
And you boil it down. There's a bad guy and he gets the bad guy out.
Yeah. Okay. So that's pick a card and I'll find it, right? So what I'm saying is you can still have a card selected, but we need a lot more barriers in the way and little interesting moments. And there's a much broader thing happening. But at the end, it all boils down to, yes, I found your card. But usually what I'm saying is, not only did I find your card, but I did like a billion other things that are much more impressive than that.
Well, do you think that it's harder for someone to explain? In other words, that they always say that something should be explained within one sentence easily.
Of course.
You know, my card was stuck to the ceiling.
Yeah, I believe that 100%. And I follow that theory when I write my books. The last trick that I did I take a shuffle deck of cards that we used in the show, yeah. and I riffle them, and I basically put the cards in order. And
you don't think that's confusing?
No, because I can write that. Okay, I'll explain why. You know what the effect is as it's written up in the book? The effect is the performer demonstrates his ability to put a deck of cards into perfect numerical order in a fraction of a second. That's exactly what happens.
That's exactly the way it appears, certainly.
Yeah. That's a six-minute trick that takes, in the book, I think that took, 18 pages to write. So, yes, it's very complicated, but in essence, that's what happens. So can you explain a Bond movie in a few lines? Of course you can. Mm-hmm. Of course you can. Mm-hmm. A villain is trying to do X, Y, Z. Bond tries to do it, but the villain doesn't do this. The villain left his vulnerability exposed somehow, and Bond took advantage of it and killed him, right?
Yeah,
So Inception. You know, try to explain Inception in one or a couple sentences.
That's why I watched that several times just to kind of go back.
It's a horrible movie. It's there's a concept there.
You think it's a horrible movie?
I do. I think that's one of the worst movies ever made.
Really?
Because it's very interesting. There's an interesting point there, but it's so convoluted and so confusing that you shouldn't need to watch it eight times to start to understand little bits and pieces of it.
2001 A Space Odyssey could be the same way.
There's a difference between... Okay, so the word that we're getting to here is clarity. You may have a great story, but if you can't clearly convey what... We don't even know if Leonardo DiCaprio was a good guy or bad guy for half the movie.
Well, that's true.
We had to watch it four or five times to start realizing the depth of the dream thing.
Right.
For example, Nolan does this. Memento, that's another movie. You have to watch that.
I love Memento.
You have to watch it.
I've got that on DVD.
Six times. It's very fascinating to watch, but the clarity. Try explaining that to someone who's never seen it before.
Guy has short-term memory. That's basically it.
But I'm saying when the person watches the movie, you need to explain it to them to have them understand what's happening. Because it's going to take half the movie for them to start realizing. Because story, as we know it, has like a beginning, middle, and end. And we're not prepared for Nolan's style of all over the place. For example, Dunkirk. I watched Dunkirk and I noticed there was a few confusing moments in that. Did you realize in Dunkirk that there's three separate plots happening? There's a plot that happens over the course of an hour.
Yep.
There's a plot that happens over the course of a day.
And then the whole movie.
Yeah. And he cuts without telling you. So you don't know that until you watch it a second time.
I didn't care for the movie so much, personally.
When a scene cuts, you assume that it's forward in time. Like, okay, that happened. And you would never assume that, now the movie cuts, so we're way back at the beginning of the movie. You know, you wouldn't think that.
Right.
So what happens is, as you're watching this movie, you'll start to figure that out, but that means that you're not watching the movie anymore. You have now start thinking inward and saying, I think I know what's happening here. He's moving back in time. But that's
Pulp Fiction was that way. Pulp Fiction was completely
but what happens is you have to start thinking inward, and you are now thinking inward, trying to process what's happening in the movie. Meanwhile, the movie's happening.
Yeah.
You know, so while you're busy trying to analyze what's, you're going to say, wait a minute, this happened, and then, I see. And then, plot is still coming out. So that's why you're missing, you've literally turned the movie off for 3 or 4 minutes while you're trying to figure these things out.
Yeah.
That's not a good method. It's very artistic, but it fights the clarity. So when I do my shows and put together my acts and everything, my number one goal is, once I've got all my technical things and all that, the plot I'll figure it out, is my audience 100% following me? Right on the money, without me spelling. I don't want to get to the point where I'm spelling it out.
Right.
So obviously not on the nose, but I want them to be able to come along with me, like in that carded any number routine. You know, here, let's talk about tracking. Where could you get lost in that? We put the card in, I shuffle, now I know where it is. You can't get lost there.
Right. Then you explain it as you go.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm teaching in a real nice, subtle way. And then I say, just because I'm tracking doesn't mean I'm going to win. Well, that's a very simple, understandable sentence. You know, and the people go, yeah, that makes sense. So I say, let me show you what I have to do if I want to win. I have to move cards around. Well, how could you get lost in that? And now we're on to the second phase. So I've took like a three-phase routine and put it in together in a way that the audience just can't get lost. They're just making perfect little connections.
From A to B to C.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now it's a nice, clear story, but it's still impossible. You know, I'm still getting all this credit for doing amazing things.
And different levels of escalating.
Exactly. And we talked about progression.
Yes.
So, of course, at the beginning, I'm just keeping track of it. And then I keep track on an even more impressive level with much more impressive shuffles. And at the end, I'm moving any card.
Talking about in the lecture, where you were saying that if somebody was just to say, you pick a card and you find it or whatever, and you do that three times, and the fourth time, if you do the same method
yeah.
again,
so like, let me I'll clear that exciting. Up. Yeah. So progression, the particular trick, it's a multiple. Just for the people that may not know that routine, there's a multiple selection routine where each time I find someone's card, I have to make sure that I'm making it more difficult each time mm-hmm. because it guarantees that they're gonna be interested each time. So for the first person's card, I'm just guessing. I'm just saying of any of the four of you, you know, was this somebody's card? So that means I had a little leeway there. On the next person's card, I say, no, specifically, I'm going to find this second person's card. You, yes, you right there. Only your card, which means now of the remaining 51 cards in the deck, I only have one shot. So it is harder. And on the third one, I divine the card before I find it. So now I'm...
You tell them the card.
Yeah, exactly. Now the cards have been mixed, the deck's sitting on the table. And to make this one harder...
You just look in their eye.
Yeah. And I said, I'm looking right at you. And I say, I'll see if I can figure out what it is first. So that, again, the audience may suspect, yeah, but how can he do that? That's not possible. And yet I'm doing it again.
Right.
And then the last one is this fancy one-handed cut that produces the wrong card and then visually changes right when the clock is running out right to the last time. So that's impressive again. But the broader point here is not only is each one getting more impressive, but what you were saying is if I cut to the first person's card, just cut to it and find it, then I cut to the second person's card and I find it, and then I cut to the third person's card and find it, well, what kind of dramatic tension am I going to get on the fourth person's card? Of course the audience knows I'm going to do it. I just did it three times in a row.
Sure.
There's no like, well, let me see you do it now. So I constantly have to remind myself when I look at my material is I always want the audience to feel, well, okay, you're good, but I don't think you can do this because that's a little too far, but yet I still do it. Mm-hmm. So since I'm always achieving and always winning, I'm building this prestige. Like I keep getting more and more impressive. So I have to make sure that when I continue my show, I'm still getting people to wonder, okay, well, I as good as you are, I really don't think you can do that.
That's why
new deck order one at the end there.
Right.
You know, I've done so many amazing things for 35 minutes when I get to the end, and I don't want them to say, oh, well, I mean, obviously you can, you've done so many amazing things.
Of course you
can do this. I still need them to go, okay, you're good, but not that good. And I continue.
Even at the very end.
All the way to the end.
See, I'm thinking, for an example, of the Fusillade trick, where that's just multiple card selections and revelations. And each of the revelations are all good, but I wouldn't say, when I've seen that effect, and when I do it myself even, I couldn't say that one is necessarily better than the other, although you try to save the best to the last, but all the rest are kind of different, but kind of impossible, but not progressively impossible.
I am very strict about that stuff. Very mm-hmm. strict. There's effects that I've created that I just have this kind of middle of the road feel in the middle of it. Like yeah. I don't feel like, in other words, it may start out well, but then it kind of just kind of stays
plateaus a little bit.
And mm-hmm. then there's a nice big finish. And
I
don't like that. I hate to sound that way, but I won't do it. I need to solve that before I go out because I just don't like that little lull there. So in the back
you
of
don't
my,
like to stay at the plateau.
I don't like the fact that it grows and then I need, what I'm saying is I want to get rid of that plateau and find some way in that flat part to create a little bit more of a lift. Mm-hmm. And I won't actually bring material like out that to perform until I feel like I've solved a way to make something more
impressive. Where do you practice that?
Well, there's a difference between practice and rehearsal, of course. When I rehearse.
I should say, where do you rehearse that?
Yeah. When I rehearse, it's very only
make coffee shop of friends.
No, I at home. I'll have students that is it like a safe place to try new material because yeah. I'll finish a session, a face to face session with someone, and I'll say, oh, while you're here, you know, I'll show you something that I'm working on, and that allows me the freedom to try out some new material. A complete stranger, I'm always a fan of if I ever see people. The other day, I was in Kansas and there was three girls out playing some card game, and I was walking past them and I said, oh, cards. You mind if I mean, I'm not very good, but I learned a card trick once and I want to see if I still remember it. I you know.
Yeah. Downplay it.
yeah. It's like,
as much as you
yeah,
can.
Yeah. Let's see. How does this go again? You know? So anyway, and of course they don't know that, you know, it's like
that you're a professional.
Yeah. That this is what I do for a living. It was pretty funny. So anyway, I'll find those types of situations. But when you rehearse and I only if you really understand rehearsing, you'll understand this. And you just get in the mood and you're really there. There's people there. Your timing is there. Your little ad-libs are there. And you can do a routine and you'll find that you get little moments and little ad-libs that'll pop right out. Exactly. So, but if you don't rehearse regularly, you won't really understand that vibe. But also, you have to have performances under your belt to be able to rehearse the right way too. Mm-hmm. So, because you can put yourself in that place, you can really put yourself in that conversation, that mood, and that mindset, and you'll be really surprised that when you're rehearsing, all sorts of really cool little moments will happen. So, I find that when you rehearse over and over again, you can start to kind of solve some of those little problems you may have with a routine. You might discover some little moment or a way.
Might be something for an example that you have a little line which is going to be a good piece of misdirection or a glance where that you can peek at the card.
All sorts of things mm-hmm. happen in rehearsal. And I might want to say this. I'll pass this little tip on here. No matter how many times you rehearse, you can never prepare fully for real life. It's just, you can rehearse a trick for 10 years and not.
You were just talking about that, about memorizing a deck, and you could do that for 3 weeks or 3 months.
Oh,
and
I
have. When you do it the first time, it's like.
Yeah, you go blank. But I have an even better story than that.
Okay.
I'm doing this show. And listen to this. You tell me how many rehearsals you would have done and caught this moment. I say to this woman, I say, in a moment, I'm going to spread. I mean, this is standard pattern. In a moment, I'm going to spread to the cards. I want you to touch the back of a card. And that's the card that we'll use. And, of course, I spread to the cards. And she picks the card. She puts it on the table. And I say, okay, Ruth, what I want you to do, I want you to look at that card and then show it to everybody. And I'll turn my back, okay? So look at the card and then show it to everybody. Make sure I don't see it. I mean, we're all on. The trick hasn't even begun yet. Like, uh-huh. The hard part, this is brand new material for me, too.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten to the good. So I turn around, and I'm waiting. And I say, Ruth, have you shown the card? And she's like, not yet, but she sounds a lot further away. So I'm like, is it okay to turn around? And I turn around, and she's walking around showing the card.
In the audience.
There's like 45 people in this place, and she's showing this person and this person and this, because wow. I said show everybody in the room. So she's this person, and
one
I'm
at
like,
a time.
And I'm up, and she's only like 6-7 people in, and I'm like, you can come back to the thing. And she just continued to go around the room, and I'm like, this is like going to take like 4 minutes. Now, how many rehearsals would you do where you would expect? So see what I mean? You just cannot. There's no substitute for real life.
Well, that's true, because you know, you can always say, well, I think I've seen it all. But as soon as you say that, the nearing next performance.
Listen to this. I do a mental effect where, and I don't do very much. It's not really a mental thing. It's more of a skill that I don't quite understand. I don't claim to do mentalism, but I will say things like, you know, you handle a deck of cards, you start to develop a sense for the cards, kind of a thing. And I spread the cards out like this, and I make this beautiful fan, and I go to this woman in the audience, and I say, I just want you to think of a card. Okay, mm-hmm. Think of a card. And I'm holding the fan like this. And of course, I get to the end of the trick, and I say, okay, so the card you're thinking of is the Queen of Clubs or something. And she goes, no. And I remember thinking, well, that's not possible. It had to, because my material's
yeah.
It's always bulletproof. It's 100%. Solid. Yeah. There's never any. So, and I go, well, what card were you thinking of? And she goes, the Seven of Hearts or something. And I thought about it. And then after the show, I remember talking to her and I said, mm-hmm. You know, when I fan those cards out, do you remember seeing the card? And she goes, no, I just thought of the Seven of Hearts.
Right.
She just thought of a card. Because I said,
think
of
her.
Yeah. So for the rest of my life,
also.
Yeah, for the rest of my life, I got to do this now. I spread the cards and I say, I want you to think of any one of these cards here. You know, I you wouldn't think.
Look at one of these cards you see.
Yeah. I wouldn't think in that you would have to do that. But because of that, I learned the hard way. But it proves that rehearsal's just not good enough. Because in rehearsal, you would always fan them out and say, think mm-hmm. of a card. You wouldn't think that. Mm-hmm. Because there's nobody there. You don't get any feedback. And the other thing I realized from rehearsal is, like in a real conversation, us as humans, I'm reading your body language. Are you giving me signals that you may not be picking up what I'm saying? Are you a little confused, or maybe you're distracted, or what?
Not right? interested, whatever.
So yeah. So as humans, we read each other.
Of course.
And if you're giving someone directions to your home and they're looking and they do this, you all of a sudden you realize you need to go all over it again.
Right.
When you rehearse, it's just empty chairs and a mirror. So your patter is a one-way street. You say your lines one after another the way you're memorizing them.
Mm-hmm.
And when you perform, you start to do that, you know, robotic script, but all of a sudden you're looking at real people and you may get mixed signals. So that's when you need to like veer off and fix things and whatever. So you have to have a lot of real life experience on performing in front of people to make better time of your rehearsals.
Right.
If that makes sense.
And so when you were actually on the tour bus and you were reading this book and practicing all this, and you had some people, I guess, that you could
practice with. Oh, on the road? Oh, yeah. It was great, because I had all those guys in the bands and everything, and they were old school. I mean, B.B. King's band was like 15 old black blues guys that were all in their 60s. So they played bridge. And boy, I tell you, kids today, a 14-year-old kid doesn't know what bridge is, you know? Uh-huh. So I have created a bunch of bridge routines, but I only reserve bridge routines for when I know I have bridge players. Period. Sure. Yeah. So I don't, in my normal show, I would never say, let's talk about bridge. And actually, that's not true. There is a trick that I have come up with where I talk about bridge, but I gently teach it as I go. I specifically say, we don't have to worry about learning how to play bridge, but just so you know, bridge deals with the suits. And that's good enough for any average person to just say, okay, I don't need to worry about, you've softened the responsibility of them having to think, oh, I've got to learn something. They just say, oh, he's going to be talking about suits from now on.
Yeah.
So it's very soft. But for hardcore bridge players, I'll go right for the throat, and I use terminology and
but you're able to use those
consistent
guys
consistent with the
really
rules.
Really,
oh boy, are those guys! And again, too, they just don't know these things exist, you know.
And they don't hang around magicians.
They have no idea, and they think they can catch. You know, they're all like, I've been playing bridge for 40 years, son. You couldn't cheat in our game. We'd catch it in a heartbeat, you know, that kind of thing. So I say, oh, well, you know, is this a fair shuffle? You know what I mean? And how about this one? Is this a fair shuffle? Okay, so we've got two fair shuffles, all right? And of course, we can see that this is a fair and honest cut. And if you and I were playing cards for money and we cut the cards fair like that, you would say that that was fair. And the guy goes, yeah, that's fair. Show me something. And then, of course, I start dealing the cards out, and I just keep giving myself each one of the spades. Yeah. And after the third or fourth spade, they all just get up and walk. They're, you know, the black reaction thing, you know. Yeah. They get up and walk away. But it was funny, because that gave you, like, a different when you tour, there's politics, cliques. If you're with the big national acts, that's the thing. And you're not, if you're the opening act, you're, you know, the green rooms are separate.
I can imagine that.
And that's just an unsaid kind of rule there. Like, you're not allowed to, like, they're different catering and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, but when you, magic is that ultimate icebreaker thing, you know, and boy, you were hanging with, you know, I'd be in the room with B.B. King showing these guys card tricks, you know, and magic, and you know this from performing, you're like the guy that they want to show off. So you're with just walking down the hall, and one of BB's guys would grab you and say, hey, come here, you know, show this guy, you know, they want to show you off, you know, that kind of a thing. So it was a great experience to be able to use magic and have that be part of that whole music scene. But that's where I would practice some of those things. So I'd be reading the books, working on the technical stuff, and every night you're in a different city, so you have different opportunities. And of course, I mean, I would practice in Starbucks and things like that, or little coffee places, and inevitably, someone always comes up and says, you know, you mind if I ask you what you're doing, you know, and you just say, oh, I'm just an amateur, really, but I suppose I can, you know, 2 minutes later, the deck's in perfect order after they shuffle the deck 10 times, you know, and he said, oh, I guess
anybody can do that.
Yes. And that's my character. I really do love that stuff. You sell it like that trick where I riffled at corner, this poor person who's like probably in their mid-20s is leaving the coffee house with their souvenir deck of cards, convinced that if they go home and deal the cards into two piles, they'll be able to separate reds from blacks, you know?
Just with that little riffle.
Yeah. Or, you know, doing out of this world there. And the guys, I just play like, you know, I've been really working on this stuff. If you just hold a card long enough and really tell yourself what the color is, you can just put it in the right pile. Why don't you try it? You know, and then he does it. And I'm like, that's what I've been talking about. And the guy leaves like convinced
that he can do it.
He can do it when he gets home. And he doesn't know who I am. He just knows that he can do it.
You're some random guy.
So presenting it. And that's just kind of the person I am. I don't like to be, in real life, I'm quite introverted. I don't like, it's always, do you want to go out or stay home? It's like, please, let's just stay home and watch a movie or something.
A lot of magicians are that way.
So that's what makes me do that downplay. When I'm out, I would never say, oh, I'm one of the best magicians in the world, and here, I'll show you what I'm working on, and I'm a published author, and there's all my accolades, and I performed across the country and Europe. And I say, like, I don't even know if this would work. And my grandfather showed me this years ago, you know, but I don't even let's see if this works. And then, of course, you just do some crazy thing and say, I've never seen that work before. I can't believe today, you know. And it's like a little Easter egg for me. I think it's pretty funny. It makes it good for a good story.
Well, I'll tell you, as we start to wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So my question is, what is your philosophy of life? What is your magic word, or what do you live by?
Oh, boy, I didn't prepare for this at all. But I really, there's a lot of things, and it's going to take me, I have to figure out which one to go with.
Yeah.
There's the all or nothing thing where you really like, you know, if you're going to try something new, really give it everything you've got. Don't give up on things too soon. So that's why, like, when I got into fitness, I got completely shredded. I would work out every day. I would run every day. I'd eat healthy. And I look like I should be on the cover of a men's fitness magazine. So I just went off. But I did the same approach. I talked to a lot of different trainers, and I met with different people, and I put myself around the right people and asked the right questions. Said, what books do I get? What do I research? And continued with that thing in my life, you know? And with golf, I was interested in golf. My brother taught me how to play, but then I wanted more. I woke up one day and I said, I want to be better. So I talked with the pro, and I got lessons, and I had my clubs fitted, and I met people and found the author to certain books and content, you know, emailed them and had discussions with them, and they would tell me what books to read and daily processes and piano. I would talk to other musicians and see who do I listen to and who do I study with. I don't care how far these people, Darwin was 8 hours away. So I got in my car and drove there. You know, I don't care.
Yeah.
So that approach, if you're interested, it doesn't matter if it's art or cooking or whatever, do as much research as you can, find the right people, surround yourself with people that are so much better than you, and be inspired and take that all the way. Because I think what people do is they dabble and they say, oh, that's not for me. Well, you never really experienced it.
You didn't jump into the water.
Yeah, exactly. You really got to get in. You got to get banged around and hurt, and you got to let your pride go. In other words, when that's you find point. A mentor, you need to surrender. So I have some students, and I'm very particular about my students. You need to show me that you're willing to do this stuff. I have the 30 years of experience. You have nothing. So do not tell me how things work. You know, that thing. A student of 2 months. Oh, well, when I do it, it does this, and I it's so much better, and I see what you're saying, but I'm going to do it my way. They, in their world, in their experience, that is right for them. That's their reality. That's their little circle. And in their world, they are right. So they have that sense of, I am right. And so you need to, when you get around these mentors, you need to realize that they have lots of experience. And I know it from things like Darwin. Everything he's ever said has come true. Maybe I didn't believe him in the front. You know, when he first said it, I said, well, okay, you're great and all, but that one, I don't really, you know, sure enough, 5-10 years later, whatever, however long it took, true. Your mom, everything your mom says comes true. You know what I mean? When I was younger,
not when
I'm
you're
like,
young.
I like my room messy because I know where everything is.
Sure.
Nope. Eat fruits and vegetables. You know, you get older and you're like, wow, you know, my body doesn't hurt 24/7 and I have energy and I can think straight, you know?
Yeah.
Clean, brush your teeth, do this, you know, have a journal, all those things that she said, it's all true. So, The point that I'm making is really get in there and, you know, with magic, and you've only been in it in 2 years or whatever, you don't know anything. Just let yourself know there's always someone else out there that knows more, and find those people and learn those approaches, and don't shut yourself off to one little thing. You know, really, even though you might not do that stuff, I study mentalism and coins and cups and balls and all that stuff because there's concepts there. You know?
Even illusions.
Yeah, exactly.
It could be applied
if anything, it's anything susceptive. So just get into your field and study, study, study. That way it's nice and fresh all the time. It's always new. And whatever else, there's more to life than magic too. You know, get out there and experience lots of other things, because I always find that when something else is interesting, something else I enjoy, I can usually find a way to bring that in. So movies, I love movies.
So do I.
And you can always find ways in patter to say, hey, does anyone know that scene in a movie? And you do some iconic scene, you know? And then you have your, what is it called? Universal experience, where everyone in the audience goes, oh yeah, I know that. And then you do some sort of card trick that relates to that thing. So it just makes your life so much more interesting. And you just live a whole much more enjoyable life. And when people bring these topics up, you can contribute to the conversation because you've really kind of jumped into all those things.
Because you've been enjoying other life experiences.
Yeah, exactly. And that's ultimately what life is. I've had this thinking popped into my brain a long time ago, but life really is about those experiences. sharing experiences. You gave me this scotch because you love it. Mm-hmm. If I have a great cigar, I don't say, oh, I want to buy 100 of these because I love them. I say, I want my friend Arthur to have this because I love it. It's great.
Right.
Or I know who would love this. Or look at this painting. My mom would love this. Or it's about that shared things so that we can communicate with other people, get their feedback, pass this great thing on to them. And then, of mm-hmm. course, when I pass this thing on to you, what do? You say, this is great. But and then you may have something that you say, oh, well, that reminds me of this. And then that's how we work. Otherwise, we're just, you know, we're not sharing, we're not communicating, we're isolating, and it's all working the wrong way. So, you know, that's not a very concise answer, but it's kind of just when you get into something, get passionate about it, get in there and really have some fun. It's in there. You just got to find it. And don't give up on anything too soon. That's kind of what it boils down to.
A lot of really good stuff in there.
Great. Well, good. Hey, trying.
Jason, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. This was great. I had a great time. And I was worried that we would ramble all over the place, and we kind of did, but it felt good.
Good. I enjoyed it too. I'm sure the listeners will as well.
I hope so.
So thank you very much. I appreciate your words. And I think, again, a lot of us will learn from that as well. So until next time, that was Jason LaDany, and this is Scotty Out.
I want to thank Jason LaDany for being my guest here this week on the Magic Word Podcast. And it was a lot of really interesting things he had to discuss there, and quite thought-provoking as well. And the book he has, by the way, which is called Confident Deceptions, is available from Vanishing Inc., but we also have it available, of course, on their website here. If you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, look for our magic store, and you'll find it over there. And this is quite a book, actually, that he was selling on his lecture tour. It has 240 pages. It says over 150 full-color photographs, and it also has a performance DVD that is in the book as well. And it has a lot of information. It's a mixture of magic and gambling demonstrations and 18 different routines. Anyhow, very well produced and recommended then also. So that's available on our website that you can purchase that. And as I said, his next book, which is going to be called Game Changer, will be a continuation of that, and it also will be available soon. Again, when it is a release, we'll have it here on the Magic Word, but also that you can get that fresh whenever that he releases it at Magic Live. You know, every year that Stan Allen always likes to have something a little bit different each year. That is that he likes to make sure that the dealers have something new that they're presenting for the first time at Magic Live to make it, you know, even more exciting. So this year's convention should be a lot of fun then also. And speaking of conventions, that's where I'm going to be next week. So I invite you to tune in to the Magic Word Podcast for daily updates from the convention floor in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where the International Brotherhood of Magicians will be hosting their annual convention. And that's going to be running from July 4 through 7, or as they say overseas, 4 through 7 July. But you will be able to hear everything that's going on over there, or as much as I can get around to each day, whenever that you tune in to the Magic Word here. And now it's time for a couple of product reviews from Murphy's Magic Supplies. If you don't follow us yet on Facebook, I recommend that you go to Facebook and you can look for The Magic Word Podcast and like our page. From time to time, whenever I do receive a box full of products that Murphy sends me for review, I have an unopening or an unboxing. So this way you can kind of see what the products look like as I am discovering them for the first time myself, as well as just a couple of updates and what's happening on the podcast and what we've just done, what we've got coming up in future weeks. So just a little snippet of that and other relevant information that might be of interest to you. So nevertheless, again, go over to facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast and like our page. First up this week is Paul Harris Presents Haunted 2.0 by Mark Taversoni. Now, Mark is a friend of mine from England, and I had spent some time with him and been a guest in his home when I was over lecturing there some years ago. But the the presentation, I should say, the effect itself of Haunted is effectively that. It is a haunted pack. That is that you have a card returned to the deck, and then the card cuts itself and the card comes out. The difference is that you are not wearing any kind of a hookup. There's not an invisible thread reel, not an ITR. It's not any kind of invisible loops, invisible thread of any kind that is apparent. And in fact, after the card is selected, returned to the deck, you can walk to the other side of the room and it will happen all by itself. Let me also say that the beauty of this is that it is a normal deck. You can borrow anyone else's Redback Bicycle deck or Phoenix deck or whatever that that you're using and ring in this one cold card, you know, basically that you just need to add this one card, which allows you the ability to do this really cool looking effect. And it is something that doesn't happen real quickly, which I think is the beauty of this, because if it's a haunted pack, it should move fairly slowly. But the idea is just exactly what I said, where that a card is selected and that when you put it back into the deck somewhere in the middle and then you square up the pack, then stand back, and then slowly the top part of the deck starts to slide off, and then the other card, one card slides out and then pops out. And it is all self-contained in the gimmick that is in this one card that you get with Haunted 2.0. Also, that you do get the special something that you're going to need to make this happen, so that if something should break, wear out, or get loose, that you can make it then again. And there are additional little stickers that are necessary in order to make this work, and so that way that if you need additional ones, that you can use that then too. There is something else I would recommend. This is something I don't know if you guys have seen or used before, but it is a product that's called Aileen's Tack It Over and Over. That's A-L-E-E-N-E apostrophe S, Tack It, T-A-C-K apostrophe I-T, Over and Over. So it's Aileen's Tack It. It's a product made by Aileen's. It's called Tack It Over and Over, and you can get it, I believe at Michael's or Hobby Lobby or some sort of a little DIY store. But the reason I'm telling you about this is because that it is used for material, but you can make little drops, however large of a globulate that you want to make. And after it dries, it starts out white like Elmer's glue, but basically whenever it dries, it comes out clear and makes a tacky, very tacky kind of flat sticker, if you will. So you can then peel it off and then use that. So I'm just saying that the Haunted 2.0 comes with these little stickers, which you can get replaced, you know, later anyway. But if there are other tricks that you might be needing some little sticker that you can make for yourself of a smaller or larger size, you can make them on demand for yourself and as many quantities as you want, because it's a fairly good size bottle. What am I going to say? Probably about a 6-ounce bottle, I guess, here. No, it says 4-ounce bottle. And it's a plastic squeeze tube, basically, and something I recommend. Anyhow, completely aside from this trick, I'm just saying that just makes nice little sticky dots. That's something that is necessary, that you do need some sticky dots that come with this, along with the rest of the stuff that comes with this. They do have a couple of different routines in here as well, as far as the presentation, as to how cards are selected and returned to the deck, whether it's going to be, at a bar or in a formal setting, or whether that you're in a cocktail strolling environment, whether that you can set it on someone's hand, perhaps. You might have to, it'd be better if you do set it on table. It'd be good for restaurant work or whatever. And what I like about this also is how that you can take this one card, and it's not something that has to be in the deck all the time, although it can be, and they explain that also, how you can gimmick the box, card box, so this way that the card can be there, and whenever you need it, you can pull it out from the inside or the outside. Very, very interesting technology and thoughts on that. A lot of good thinking that Mark Taversoni has put into this. Again, this is called Haunted 2.0, Paul Harris Presents, by Mark Taversoni, and I would highly recommend this. Well, let me rephrase that. It is something that is a gimmick that has to be added, so it's something else that, as far as pocket management goes, you may have to make room for this, although you can have it added to your card box and then put that in. But again, from time to time, the sticker may get such that it loses its tackiness, which is why you may need to replace that. And also the special something that's attached in there that might break or stretch that you need to get that. It can wear out, so it's not something that's going to last forever, that's for sure. So again, because of the fact that it is something that you're going to have to, you can use many, many, many times before it does break or needs to be replaced. But because it does need to be replaced and because it is something extra that you're going to have to carry, it is a very strong effect. The haunted pack is always a strong effect. And the fact you don't have to have a hookup, I think, is the beauty of this. So I would say this is recommended almost highly. What would I say? Between recommended and highly recommended, somewhere in there. I like it. Next up is another product that is for using playing cards, and it's called Gum Founded by Steve Rowe, and it's from Big Blind Media. This is a pretty cool effect. Let me tell you also, it's modular, meaning that you can plug and play. You can use any part of this for your routine to go as short or as long as you would like. But basic effect is that you have a card selected, return to the deck, and then you talk about mind-reading gum, that you have a pack of double mint gum and open it up, take out a piece, tear it in half. You can give them half and you chew it because you say that this particular gum aids your ability to read her mind or his mind to find out what card it was they had selected. After you've done that, you hold the packet of gum right in front of their eyes. I mean, and they could see that it says double mint. As you pass your finger over the front of it with your finger spread wide, there's no turnover or anything. The packet changes visibly from where it says double mint to five of diamonds, four of hearts, or whatever that the card would be. So it actually changes, and you can then hand that to them. They can see then on there that definitely that is what it says. That is a great effect in and of itself, and you can walk away and that's done. To carry it then a step further, then they have you can take out another stick of gum, and as you're turning it over, showing that it says double mint, but you say that their card was the five of diamonds, and then when you run the gum through your hand again, you then show that both sides of the stick of gum with the wrapper on the wrapper now says five of diamonds. And as you dump out all of the rest of the remaining packets of gum, all the wrappers also say five of diamonds on both sides, that they can take a stick of gum with the wrapper and go home with it as a little souvenir or whatever as well. If you want to go even further in that, they could have the card, whenever they open up one of the sticks of gum, they pull it out of the wrapper, unfold it from the foil, they will see a card. Five of diamonds is folded up and inside there. Now, there are other variations that you could do in which that you could have, let's say, the five of diamonds on the outside, and then on the inside could be a couple of other, have another card. So you have two cards selected, and as you open it up to the inside, whenever you would show a stick of gum, that it now says the four of hearts or whatever. So they have a different card that's going to then be on the inside, which would be the second person's card. You can also have a torn card, so you have a torn corner, and whenever they get to the card inside, the corner of the stick of gum is, the card that is in the packet and the foil that's folded up in there is matches. And there are some nice little tips and things that are included on the online instructional video. I was a little bit reticent, I should say, about whether I was going to like this effect or not. I thought it was basically going to be just a paddle move, and you can just wrap a cover around a pack of gum and show that, and that's the end of it. But it's so much more, so much deeper, and that's only perhaps one small phase of this whole routine if you put it all together. So I think it is a very clever routine. Again, modular, you can kind of plug and play different things. And there were a couple of tips in the video that I can apply to other things, in fact, that having nothing to do with gum. And you'll see what I mean whenever that you purchase this. But it is something that I think is clever, and you would carry around. You know, gum is... quite organic. It's something that is in the context. I mean, if you carry gum that you would, you know, hand out and give somebody, and it's not just your typical card trick. So, but it is, once again, having something to do with some pocket management. You're going to have to make room for this. And it also is not instantly resettable, because obviously you've torn a piece of gum in half and you've given half out and you chewed part of it, and then you have to go back and replace that. So if you're doing this in a cocktail setting or a restaurant, you're going to have to go back and reset. So this would be something that I wouldn't necessarily do over and over and over and table to table, but it is something, if it's going to be something special. Certainly looks fantastic on television. I don't know the television rights are reserved there or not. One other thing, by the way, too, that when you get this, that when it gives you the online URL for downloading this and it gives you the password, the font that they used on the card, that is the instructional card that comes with all of the gimmicks and everything that you need, is all in capital letters. Actual password is all in lowercase. And so I'm telling you that in advance, because I've tried that at first thinking it was supposed to be all caps. But again, the font that they had used for the instructions was all caps. So that can be kind of confusing. Very small thing, because Big Blind Media does a great job. They have very professionally done videos, and I've always enjoyed the stuff that they put together. So once again, this is another one of their winners, and one that I would recommend. Steve Rao's Gum Founded. And again, I recommend it. Well, there are two card tricks following a nice podcast we had with a card magician. So I think it seemed rather appropriate that we had these two things available that we could review for you here this week. Both a couple of really fine products that I think are worth your attention. And I hope that you appreciate my reviews that I'm giving here from time to time, and it helps in your decisions of buying good magic. And again, whenever that you do buy good magic, be sure to think of the Magic Word Podcast whenever that you go over to our magic store and consider buying things from us there. While I'm at it right there, then also, that you can also help us by using Amazon.com. If you just go over again through the Magic Word Podcast, you'll see an affiliate, Amazon affiliate link there. And if you'll click that, it will take you to Amazon. So that way that they will help fund us with a portion of any of your purchases. Well, once again, this has been a pretty full episode, so I'm going to try to wrap this up fairly quickly here. Just to remind you that next week we'll be reporting from Grand Rapids with some daily reports from the IBM convention there. And if you can't make it, then you can tune in and listen. It's the next best thing to being there. If you are there, be sure to say hello, and perhaps I'll have my microphone with me so that I can put you on the podcast and we can kind of get your opinions of what you think of what's going on at the convention and what you have purchased and what you've been doing, etc. So I always like to hear from listeners and talk with you while I see you at conventions. And that's really the best place for us to try to connect. So I hope that we can connect while we're in Grand Rapids. If not, then please tune in and listen. And while I'm at it, then also, that if you can support us with your financial donations, that would be greatly appreciated so that you can become a friend of the Magic Word. All the information is over there on themagicwordpodcast.com. So until next week from Grand Rapids, stay well, get booked, and whatever you do, put everything into it. Do the best you can and give it your all. This is Scotty out.